Today is Sunday, May 3rd, 2015.
May 3rd today,
am I right?
May
3rd today. May 3rd today. Friday was May 1st. People were marching May 1st on Thursday already. Not lechallel Shabbat, Baruch Hashem. So, May Day and all that goes with it. Once again, Rabbi Lichtenstein is gone. It's a new world. But Mendafkin Vita, we don't have a choice. I hear it. Excuse me? We don't have a choice. Yeah. So do me a favor. Sit near here and adjust.
Who's replacing him?
No one's replacing him. His son is replacing him. Yeah. Moshe is the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Maidan and Rabbi Diki. Okay. But the world has to continue, and learning has to continue, and the world has to move on. It was a moving night in memory of Rav Aaron here at Gris Monday night. And this Tuesday, we also have a memorial here in memory of Whitey Horowitz, the man who was the first dean and the guide and, the visionary who founded BMT. And today, there are endless institutions that emulate BMT, and since BMT began in 1969 with 10 students, and I was one of the Rebbeim, tens and tens and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Anglos have studied in Israel. A good percentage has come in Aliyah, and the rest is history. Now, we're in Toronto with the Erev, and we're dealing with a very interesting individual, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart, who comes to Toronto after World War I. He was a Yudapeyesha Rav, a successful Rav, and he had become a Mizrahiite, and finally, times were ripe for him to leave Eastern Europe and to come to Toronto, where he succeeded Rabbi Rosenberg, Rav Yudel Rosenberg, as the Rav in Toronto. Rav Yudel Rosenberg moved on to Montreal, and here is Rabbi Graubart in Toronto. The first thing he attempted to do was to establish kashrut, to establish a central rabbinate. In all these endeavors, he was unsuccessful, and that's the story of Canada and the United States and the Western world. We have endless stories of rabbanim who tried to straighten out kashrut. In the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, they got absolutely nowhere. Today, the kosher scene is better in America, mainly because of the OU. And it has to be said to the credit of the OU, the Chafkei, and the OK, the three main bodies that give hashgacha. They have a check and balance system. They're not privately owned to a certain degree. And that has greatly enhanced the kashrut in the United States. There are many Haredi hechsherim. I can't vouch for how good they are. My ultimate guess is that the gold letter standard is the OU. I see the way the OU works, and I see the way the Chafkei and the OK cooperate with them. But this is something that happened after World War II. The American rabbinate came of age. The massive immigration, many of them were shomrei kashrut to the United States after World War II, and this forced kashrus into a proper mold. Unfortunately, wherever there will be people and money, there will be problems with kashrut. I can't go into any more detail, it's not for now, but this is the nature of the human being. I just spoke with someone at the Shtiblach, someone I know for many decades, while your graduate came in Aliyah a few years after we did, or slightly younger than I am, son of a sheichet and an absolute shoyma mitzvah 100%. And he's had a lot of experience, and he told me stories about YU and elsewhere, and your hair can stand on edge. And he said to me, finally, the only place you can really eat is in your own home. But even then, you're bringing products to your own home. You're not going out and shechting, etc. You're not going out and milking the cow. So we have to hope for the best. Be'ezrat Hashem, give everyone cheskat kashrut, as you just heard Rabbi Bednash's shir with sfeik sfeikot and all that goes with it. We have to hope we're doing okay. My own rule of the thumb, I have to be honest with you, is whenever I'm invited out, I always try to eat milchiks. Choose a milchik, a restaurant. Because if you make a cheshbon with kashrut, and I've seen here Haredi hechsher, I'm not just talking the rabbinet, Baruch Hashem, with milchiks, they're not going to import milk from Shechem. That's all I can say. Dailech hakima b'ramiza. But Rabbi Graubat tried in Toronto, and he didn't succeed either. Where he did succeed was, number one, he opened an advanced Talmud Torah for students where they actually taught Gemara. And number two, he built the first Erev in the Western Hemisphere where there was no machloket and everyone accepted the Erev. Now, I want to talk about the man. I will come back to the Erev in a few minutes. But I want to talk about the man because he was a very fascinating individual. He couldn't make his peace with the Chilul Shabbos in America. And he pleaded with the Balabatim, the Europeishen. Remember, I grew up in this world. Vic grew up in this world. If you recall, last week Rabbi Lem was a guest in this year. He's back in the States now. He grew up in this world. And we were dealing with Europeisha people who knew what Shabbat was, but in America, it became par for the course. You can't be sure in the Shabbos, it doesn't work out. Now, Rabbi Graubat came up with an idea, and you can get all the sources. This is from his writings. Edelman's quotes him extensively. But I just want to make mention of this because it ties in with the Young Israel movement. And I'm quoting now Rabbi Graubat in one of his forum that's widely quoted, a Sabbath letter it's called. It appeared in Toronto, 1922. Furthermore, I appeal to all congregations to guard our honor and aid in eradicating this evil public violation of the Sabbath. Let not those who employ Jews on the Sabbath day and those who keep their stores open on this day hold any office. They must not be presidents or trustees, nor should they participate in any committee. And you see, this is the whole problem. What are we going to do? You're going to be rabbis. The problem comes up now with homosexuality. Our minds have been so eradicated that they were born this way. You can't change. It's normative. The Torah says it's a sin. But all right, we don't marry them halachically. They can get married legally, civilly, and you keep on hearing this all the time. So just the other day I had a discussion with a very close friend of mine who's a Yarei V'Shalem, a Talmud Chacham, and raised wonderful children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And he asked me, what should our attitude be? I said, you have to treat them like Mechalalei Shabbos. You can't come out and say, this is good, and I don't agree with that letter that my Talmud Nati Helfgott started, that 200 Shomer Shabbos, Rabbanim, etc., Machanchim signed on. I totally disagree. I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I know where I'm coming from, but if a Mechalal Shabbos walks into shul, you're not going to tell him, get the heck out. Lehefech, if someone with the, I told him the same thing, but leave alone the homos and lesbians. Do you take a Mechalal Shabbos? Adarabba, when I was in the rabbinate, and I've seen this even with my own students, you ask them, how did you become religious? How did you become a Baal Teshuva? So young people in this very kollel told me my father's mother died, and my father felt he should say Kaddish. He didn't even know what Kaddish was, but he came into shul. The rabbi explained to him, knew from out of that Kaddish, if the rabbi yodeich lekarev, you can turn him into a total Jew. I'm a big believer in Yiddishkeit, kezera e v'kadesh. I'm a big believer. Tamu uru'u kitov. I'm a big believer. What can I tell you? I love the Torah with all my heart, and I think it can be, I'm a Talmud of the Rav, as the Rav used to say, we have a wonderful, wonderful merchandise to sell. We just have to know how to market it. So, let them come into shul, adarabba. I don't have a problem giving a Mechalal Shabbos and Aliyah. No, a lot's been written on this. The Rav felt that you let a Kohen Mechalal Shabbos duchen. The Rav felt very strongly about it because he said, if you don't let the Mechalalei Shabbos duchen, they'll forget that they're Kohanim. It's a question. There's a lot in the Achronim. I'm being very flippant, as I was accused of being. I've lectured on this. I've given sources, but it's not for now. But there's a different problem. When you take a Machalos Shabbos and you make him president of the shul, vice president, chairman of a committee, you're giving a message to the shul that a Machalos Shabbos is just as good as everyone else. Nothing wrong. I'm Shomer Shabbos. He's Machalos Shabbos. I'm Orthodox. You know the way they say pluralism. He's conservative. By the way, I'm not Orthodox. I am a Jew. And I always tell people, there's no such thing as Orthodox conservative reform. There's a Jewish way we live since God gave us the Torah. And that way of life involves Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, Talmud Torah, Tefillah, and all that goes with it. So here he's saying something very interesting, that the shuls in Toronto, all right, we have endless Mechalalei Shabbos, but don't let them be offices. Now you should know the Young Israel movement, which we may talk about someday. It's a book is supposed to come out on the history of the Young Israel. To the best of my knowledge, I have not seen the volume. If anyone knows about it, please let me know. But the Young Israel movement, which is an American development about 100 years ago exactly, it's a fallout from the east side, from the Shtiblach, that the children wanted a movement where there's no talking during davening and there's no schnodderei. You understand shuls. What was the shul about? When you got up, they called you to the Torah. Mishanada, Mishanada, Mishanada. I told you the story. I love the story in Sheepshead Bay in the big Jewish center. So Mr. Nathan, the man who was Mr. Nathan Hot Dogs, whatever his name was, he davened there. So Yom Kippur, he had a chazaka, he had shlishi. So, you know, Nathan's Hot Dogs, you know what I'm talking about. You know, he used to laugh at the world. He said, the world loves my hot dogs, the goyim line up. You know what the secret was? They were all kosher. It was all Hebrew national hot dogs.
When did they start being kosher?
Well, they were never kosher with a heksha. But
it never had a heksha?
No, it never had a heksha. But
because they were sold
Shabbos? Yeah, whatever. Goyim, they were franchised. I don't know who ran it. But he said, my chap is, the goyim never tasted salty hot dogs. Their meat is not kashered. So suddenly they have hot dogs with a different taste, a little salt. It was a big success. So when he got shlishi on Yom Kippur, every year in Shulai, I have a good friend who davened there, it's history. Everyone would be listening, not to the leining, not to the bracha, how much he's going to be mashanada. So one year, the Gabbai makes him, bavur shanada shloshim v'sheish, 36. So this guy sitting next to my friend says to him, that sheep, Adyam Kip, I don't want to use his language, that sheep, dash, dash. All he's giving is 36, and my friend says to him, you idiot, when he says 36, and meant $36,000, that's, oh, 36, Toysen, the guy Davin Musav with new kavana, the shul is going to be solvent for the next year. So this is very interesting. I don't know if the Israel movement knows the source, but here you have Rabbi Graubart fighting for shuls, Mechalalei Shabbos, welcome them, bring them in, plead with them to be Shomer Shabbos, but don't put them into positions of authority. And by the way, as far as I know, this goes on in Young Israel until today. They did have a big machloket about an upstate Young Israel in New York a few years ago where a woman was elected president. And you see, that got involved in the whole issue of feminism. A woman elected president, next thing we know, we will have rabbis, women rabbis, okay? I have to tell you, I know some of the Young Israelis, and if you have women who are activists, as long as they don't speak on Shabbos, as long as they don't make announcements, you can't usher it. But you have to know the community. You have to understand the circumstances. But it was a machlekes, and ultimately, I believe she remained president in dignity, and I'm told that's not the only Young Israel. There's another one, too, where a woman president, which I have to tell you, there's a Chassidic Rebbeim. When I was growing up, the few Chassidic Rebbeim there were minor league players, but there were Chassidic Rebbeim. So I remember one Rebbe in the Bronx said, In Europe habe ich noch gehabt Gabayim. Da habe ich noch Gabayistis. In Europe I had only male Gabayim. In America I have female Gabayistis. I don't know how to say it. It would be the female form of a Gabay, a Gabista. But, and by the way, he was right. Because I found in the rabbinate the closest people I worked with in suburbia were women, not men. The men were busy making a living, going to New York, commuting, money, money, money. The women were the heart of the shul. And without an active sisterhood, you got nowhere. But it's a real problem. And, you know, those of you raised in the big cities, you go to shuls where Kanayin Hara, 99% of the people are Shomer Torah mitzvah. But there are Orthodox shuls across America where on the average Shabbos morning, you'll find 50-50. And you have to draw the line. At times it can be delicate because someone who's active and says, why can't I be treasurer? Why can't I be secretary? It's a delicate problem. Menachem will find out. He's going to America soon. It breaks my heart. An Israeli kid.
Not next year.
Not next year. But did you ever live in America?
Not that
you can remember. You don't know what you're up against there. You know, I meet kids speak perfect English. I know my own family, some of my own grandchildren know English better than I do. But they never, you know, they were born, bred, raised here. They're fourth, fifth generation already. But you don't know what you're up against there. And then McCook of Baltimore, what's happening in Baltimore. And you don't realize that this is very deep. When you indict six policemen, I think it is, three of them are Afro-Americans. That city is going to be shaking. Oh boy. It's not Israel with the Ethiopians. We lived through the Moroccans, the Black Panthers, before you were born, okay? So, Baruch Hashem, we will survive. It's part of, if you open up Ezra and Nehemiah, you'll see the problems they have, the problems we have. Not much different. I think we're doing a little bit better today. Maybe I'm being prejudiced, but I think we're doing a little better. Now, not only that, Rabbi Graubart made history. And here you come to a very fascinating chapter. In the Kensington Marketplace, which was the heart of the immigrant community, where a marketplace, this was like Bathgate Avenue. You've heard of Bathgate Avenue in the Bronx, says Steve. Yeah, go and tell them what. Bathgate Avenue, oh gosh. Bathgate Avenue, Thursday, you're lined up to have your chicken shech. You got your bread, you got your Shabbos food, you had big vegetable stores. Those were Italians, those stores were in the hands of Taliana. They all spoke perfect Yiddish. It was an amazing Bronx. The Italians, Colin Powell, who lived in the East Bronx, he spoke perfect Yiddish. He worked in a furniture store.
They gave him a job.
Right, he was a poor kid, he was black. And the Jews treated him well. And right, correct. So everyone spoke Yiddish. So Kensington, but Bathgate Avenue, Shabbos was quiet. Although there were stores, were open Jewish stores, but at least the kosher stores were not open on Shabbos. In Toronto, no one was open. It began as a much more traditional community. By the 1920s, he had to suffer because store after store was opening on Shabbos. People were already in America 20 years, 30 years. A new generation was taking over. And this is the Chilul Shabbos that the Munkacher Rav cried about, yelled about in that famous movie. So he went into the marketplace on Shabbos and delivered four sermons, four consecutive Shabbatot. And I'm now quoting him. This was all in Yiddish, but this is English translation. It was very, and this was very famous. You got to give him credit. Who has ever heard of such a thing? A rabbi, head of a community, delivering a sermon outdoors. This is my intention, that the assembled should ask such questions. Is the custom that your children do not put on tefillin and you and your wives purchase on the Sabbath? Is this the custom, an ancient one, described from the practices of your forebears in Prujan, Herdona, Lublin, Krakow? Had you maintained the traditions of your fathers and the practices of the past, the rabbi would also have maintained the tradition and not deliver a sermon in public. You broke the customs, I break the custom of the rabbinate. And then his famous line, what is the purpose of rebuking the Sabbath violators in the synagogue where only the Sabbath observers are found? And of course, that's our biggest problem as Jews in outreach. How do you reach the people who don't come to shul? You know the expression in English, I'm preaching to the choir. And I have to say, you have benefited because something developed on the American scene today, which we never had before. In other words, when I went into the rabbinate, what were your choices? Rabbi, day school education, or Talmud Torah education? Today you have an entire new profession called outreach. And students in the kollel, forget about it. You all think college campuses, which is a terrific achievement, which hurts YU, by the way. Because when I was growing up, if you wanted to learn every day and have minyanim and daven and have kosher food, yeshiva college was the answer. Today, any kid who's not into learning, I don't want to be like Rav Lichtenstein. All right, kol hakavod to Rav Lichtenstein, but I have other goals in life. No, you can go to Yale, you can go to Harvard, you can go to Princeton, you can go to any university, and you have three minyanim a day, you have shayurim, you have kosher food, and you get a Harvard degree. Shabbos, someone introduced me to another person. I met him when I was at Harvard. My wife says to me, I said, boy, those guys are so stuck up. This is my friend. I met him in Boston. No, he wanted to make the point. I met him at Harvard. I was in graduate school. He was an undergraduate at Harvard, Shmavid. But all right, a Harvard degree. Rakevet only has a yeshiva college degree. You see how they stand in awe of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. One of his Talmidim wrote in Makori Shon, he was professor of English literature at Harvard University. I mean, with all due respects, Rabbi Aaron got a PhD from Harvard in English literature, absolutely. Henry Moore wrote a doctorate, published, etc. Loved literature, spoke about it. Rakefet got his face smacked today. Yomo will testify that a result of my hesped, quoting Rabbi Aaron with Hamlet, some former student in the Kollel, hashkafic questions, not everyone can study Hamlet and Rabbi Aaron and etc. And kids studied in Alon Shvat. No, I answered what I answered. You can, Yomo will testify. Sherry tells me she sent you a copy of my answer. Good. Yomo will testify. I'm not frightened to answer. But Rabbi Aaron, when he got his doctorate, this I couldn't say publicly, but I'll tell it to you. It's unbelievable. Rabbi Aaron says to the Rav, Rabbi Aaron told me this in these years. He says to the Rav, Rebbe, I got my doctorate. Says, Mazel Tov. Now, this is after 4 or 5 years in Harvard, studying with the Rav every Friday night at the Rav's Tish. Rabbi Aaron was one of the few Talmidim, Rabbi Aaron, the Rav's children, one or two other outsiders. These were the Rav's most intimate circle. The Rav asks him, what did you get your doctorate in? And he says, English literature. And like the Rav was a little upset, not physics, not mathematics. So Rabbi Aaron said to the Rav, Rebbe, had you told me, I would have, he would have studied whatever the Rav told him. But that little anecdote shows you something, that here's Rabbi Aaron with the Rav, his Talmud Mufa, and their whole relationship was in learning. In other words, when he gets his doctorate years later, the Rav asks him, what was your doctorate in? And it shows you Rabbi Aaron, Rebbe, had you told me mathematics? Had you told me physics? And it's interesting. When the Rav went to Berlin, his main interest was math and physics. When the Lubavitcher Rebbe went to Berlin, his main interest was math and physics. It's interesting how Gedolei Yisrael have this love and knack for math and physics. To me, it's all Latin, you understand. I do have I have a number of grandsons who are very, let me not say a word about my grandfather, very good in learning and very good in math and physics. So it must go together. I kind of, baseball knowledge and learning goes together. But all right, I may be a dat yachid. So Rabbi Aaron, the Rav, then he came to yeshiva right when he got his doctorate. But Harvard today, You can go anywhere. Who needs yeshiva college? In order to go to yeshiva college, you got to be a kid who's committed. I want to be able to learn. And that's very important. And then Richard Joel is right. Out of Lakewood may come Gedol Yisrael. Out of Harvard may come Nobel Prize winners. Yeshiva University is the only place in the world where you can have Gedol Yisrael and Nobel Prize winners under one roof. It's a great achievement. But when today you have outreach, it's a different world. And people are experts in outreach. I was just in Bal Harba, and they built a beautiful new shul. Not the shul, not Chabad. This is a few blocks away. What a shul. It's going to be open for a Shoshone Yom Kippur. A dear friend, devotee of mine, was the leading force in building this $10 million shul. And they already have someone on the staff from this kollel who's in charge of outreach. And he knows how to go after kids, and he seeks them out. But 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years ago, you got up on Shabbos, who did you talk to? Basically, Shomer Shabbos people who went against the trend. He went into the marketplace, and he let them have it. And he told them off. He told them during World War I, the Polish government forced Jews to keep their store open on Shabbat. After World War I, the communist takeover, they forced Jews to keep their stores open on Shabbat. Who is forcing you to keep the store open? And he went on and on, all the four drashot are quoted in his writings. But the insight of the man, you see, he says something else. If the women would not be religious, and then this too is a sociological phenomenon. In other words, I'm not stupid enough to think I can influence Reformed Jews. I've had run-ins a few years ago. I did the OU a favor. I went to a very famous hotel here in Jerusalem. It was the time of the World Conference of Jewish Leaders, what they call, I think, the Jewish Assembly. Correct me if I'm wrong. Oh, my gosh. Now, these are Jewish leaders. And I see this lady checking in. And I couldn't believe my ears. The lady is saying to the woman at the desk, is there a Sabbath elevator here? Like she's ashamed. And she says, I don't need it, but my granddaughter became Orthodox and she's going to visit me like an Unglück, a dear getrogen, a dear Unglück, the Enigel is a hit up Shabbos. You see, so a woman like that, where am I going to go? Tell her Shabbos, talk with her. Then they had a choice of the reform service, I think they call it innovative service, and a traditional service. The traditional service was the hotel service, was the Sephardic service. I davened there, and the dining room was open at 7 o'clock. Shabbat began that week at 4:30, 4:40. I told you the story. I've told it over the years. I still shake. So as Malka and I are walking down to the dining room, the innovative service is ending, and 300 ladies, these are leaders of the Jewish people, people who care, who come to Jerusalem for this grandiose Jewish agency affair, are lighting Shabbos candles with the rabbi 2.5-3 hours after Shabbat began. No, could you imagine? I'm going to get up there like a meshugana vikanu machalalei Shabbos. What are you doing? What are you doing? Your mitzvah baba veira. They'll look at me. I'm a meshugana, an Orthodox fanatic. You follow? But he makes the point so beautifully. These women all have religious roots. They observe many of the commandments. They don't eat non-kosher meat. They maintain a Jewish home. The stoves and ovens are kosher. They purchase meat and fish for the Shabbat, for the Sabbath. They are careful to light the Sabbath candles. And then they go and mechallel Shabbos, shop on Shabbos, go to the theater in the afternoon, and he pleads with them, be Shomrei Shabbat. Now, he was an interesting individual, and when he saw that he's not going to change the world, at least he can minimize the transgression. And that's when the idea fell into his head to build an Erev. People will carry on Shabbos, but at least let there be an Erev who, that Erev will avoid at least the basic Issa of Hotza'ah on Shabbat. He later published 4 volumes, Chabalim Bani'imim. That was the name of his collection of responsa literature. And the most important tshuva in the volumes are how he built the Erev, how he was makshir the Erev. Now, I'll talk about the Erev in a minute. I just want to pause for 1 minute and give you some scholarly technique. Yomo, do me a favor, turn on the air conditioning. It should be set on air conditioning cold at 22, okay? Great. A set of books came out a few years ago that you should be aware of and you can use it. It's unbelievable. I donated the books to the Grist Library in memory of my parents. The author is Shmuel Glick. Author of Life's Work. I believe he teaches at Bar Ilan, and evidently he also taught at the seminary in New York because the books are published by Bar Ilan, the Schechter Institute of the seminary here in Jerusalem, and the Machon Shoked Lemechache Yahadut, which is part of JTS in New York. It's called Kuntres Hatshuvot HaChadash. And in these 4 volumes, he gives you biographical details and publishing details of every sefer of responsa literature that has ever been written. In other words, he ends off with Modern Times. I believe he goes beyond the 1950s, 1960s, 70s. It is a massive, magnificent work. On the entry 1369, you'll find Chabalim ben Imim, Greibat, Rabbi Yehuda, Leib ben Binyamin. It tells you where all the editions were published, volume 1, volume 2, volume 3, volume 4, and where they were republished and what's available today. I need not tell you that all these volumes today are available basically online. You just have to be able to find them, either in the Bar Ilan or you'll find something in the Hebrew books. It's an amazing world. That's all I can tell you. What you have at your fingertips today, we had a struggle to uncover 40, 50 years ago. Now, if you go to the Encyclopedia Judaica, you will find an entry on Yehuda Leib Graubart, 1861, 1937, Rabbi and Halachic scholar, tells you a little bit about his wife, about his life. During World War I, he was removed to the interior of Russia by the Tsarist government to ensure the good behavior of the Jews of Strausdorf, his own community. They held him as a hostage. However, he was granted permission to travel, and he visited many communities in Russia encouraging the Jews. In 1917, under the Kerensky government, he helped organize Hebrew studies. And you see, there was a time right after the revolution when a government was set up that was not anti-religious. As a matter of fact, one of the ministers of this government was a Shomer Shabbos Jew. It's an amazing story. And then the whole communist takeover, the real communists, the hatred of religion, emasculated everything.
Both parties were mostly Jews. The Bolsheviks as well as the Reds and Whites.
Unfortunately, many Jews played a very big role in the revolution, as we know. We don't have to go any further than one individual named Trotsky. And it's amazing to think today that his grandson, going back to the original name, Bornstein, Avram Bornstein, is active in the Chevron community. So Trotsky was Zeicha that his descendants came back to that which has sustained us. Now, Russia, he fought that the Jews should use Hebrew, not only Yiddish. Later, when he saw it was hopeless, that's when he emigrated to Toronto, and they mention about what he did in Toronto and how he tried to build a kehillah and his plans and visions, but the greatest success was the Erev. Now, a few words about the Erev in Toronto, and you will see how that Toronto Erev actually affects some of you sitting here, although, unlike Adam, you have never set foot in Toronto. Vic, you're wondering what the Rebbe's talking about? Patience, and we will get there. Now, once again, he deals with this problem that haunts us, mukav ledira, kapif or kapaf, whichever way you pronounce it. In every big city, there are areas which are not built for people. It's built zoos, botanical gardens. It's not built for people to live. It's not mukav ledira, to use the rabbinic term, surrounded for people to live. No, parking lots. We spoke about this with London. So if you recall, I quoted to you from Rav Asher Weiss, who I don't have to tell you who Rav Asher Weiss is, one of the greats of Yerushalayim of the year 2016. So Rav Asher has dealt with these halacha l'maisa problems time and again. And I remember I quoted to you that he said, one problem that disappears in modern times, somehow the Achronim find a thousand ways to negate the problem, is mukaf ledira. And here it is. However, if the garden or park is planted, it is incorporated into the city and used by people in the city, then it does not negate the Erev and can be included in the Erev since it becomes part of the Erev community. And you see, all these parks, parking lots, call it what you wish, human beings can use it. Even in a parking lot, you can make a picnic, you can sit down, you can eat, you can drink, la briyot. You go to the botanical gardens, human beings are using it, human beings are there. Mufkaf ledira doesn't just mean a place to sleep. It means a place where humans enjoy life. And adarava, it could very well be in a big city like New York. Central Park is more mukaf ledira than a regular house. People live in homes, have no room. Central Park, stretch out. I mean, autumn, you can breathe. It's beautiful. Central Park, there's a lot to be said for this. Now, here he quotes, and this is an interesting source, and it's a correction I made in the doctorate. I'll read the sentence to you. He supports, I'm now reading from Adam Mintz's doctorate. Rabbi Graubart supports this distinction by quoting the responsum written by Rabbi Malkiel of Lumsha to Rabbi Chaim Chenowitz of Odessa regarding the creation of an Erev there in 1899. That's a fascinating line. Who's Rabbi Malkiel? No? Adam is offering a gift. He will free the man who tells him who Rabbi Malkiel. Rabbi Malkiel, one word is missing here. Rabbi Malkiel Tenenbaum. You follow? I believe his chivot were called the Divrei Malkiel. He was one of the great poskim in Lubmisha. And Divrei Malkiel, I'm correct. It's in volume 4, Tshuva 3. I quote him extensively in Aguna. It was an Adam Gadol, one of the great poskim of the generation. And for whatever the reason, Rabbi Mintz and his doctorate just wrote Rabbi Malkiel, the word Tenenbaum disappeared. So if you print that, if someone told me you printed out the doctorate on page 311, four or five lines from the bottom, add the word Tenenbaum so you'll know who you're quoting. Rabbi Chaim Chernowitz, can anyone fill me in? This is very fascinating. Rabbi Chaim Chernowitz was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. But after he got Smicha, Bucky, and Shas, he got involved in Chochmat Yisrael, and he wrote a history of the Torah Shabbal Peh, big Lamdan, but there were already questions in what he wrote. I can tell you that Menachem Elon, Professor Menachem Elon, Zeicher Tzadik Levracha, his work, Mishpat Ivri, is on a religious level, on a higher level than Chaim Chernowitz. He quotes Chernowitz. Everyone has to quote him when dealing with the history of Halakha. But Menachem Elon's work is totally within the confines of Torah and Mesorah. Chaim Chernowitz later emigrates to the United States. Can anyone tell me where he was professor? Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. So he's an interesting individual, a Talmud of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spekta, a man who corresponded with Rabbi Malkiel Tenenbaum, and he was worried about the Erev they're building in Odessa, and he corresponded with the Divrei Malkiel. Rabbi Malkiel wrote, then after you give his last name, I guess you can write, Reb Malkiel wrote that the gardens only nullify the Erev if they are not part of the residential part of the city. In Odessa, since the gardens and parks were part of the city and used by people in the city, they did not nullify the Erev. Rabbi Grabert argues that the gardens and parks in Toronto were also part of the city and used by the people of the city, so they did not nullify the Erev. Then he gets involved with the whole question of renting the city of Toronto, and you know, this is a legal fiction. How do you rent the city? How do you solve the problem of the Goyim and the Jews that don't give a hoot about an Erev? So you give the mayor of the city a dollar bill, and you rent the city Ichveis for 49 years. No, it's a bit of a legal fiction. But Rabbi Graubat cites Rabbi Yaakov Reisha, you're going back to the Shvut Yaakov, you're going back to the 1700s, who lived at the beginning of the 18th century and stated that leasing the property from the local government authorities would survive for both non-Jews and Jews who are Sabbath violators. And this was the custom in Mayans and other communities in Europe. And Rabbi Graubart fights and says, and this is repeated 1,000 times over, as you saw last year and this year by Rabbi Nasha Klein, as after all of this discussion, one can see clearly that concerning the Erev here in Toronto, one does not have to turn to paths that are far away and difficult or to rely on leniencies. This Erev has been made according to the tradition of the rabbinic authorities, from whose water we drink. All of the rules and the Greece agreements have been addressed in other cases. And in the city of Warsaw, the great city of God, people carry on the Sabbath with the permission of the greatest rabbinic authorities of the Jewish people. And you see this too, time and again. There was an Erev in Warsaw, there was an Erev in Lumsha, there was an Erev in Paris, there was an Erev in Amsterdam. All these Erevim were built with Gedolei Yisrael. Toronto is no different than Warsaw. And there was no opposition. Everyone accepted the Erev. Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg also played a crucial role. And here, Hine Matov Manoyim Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. The ability to cooperate. What you see in Alon Shvut, compare it to Panovich and Yeshiva and Sheikh. The ability to cooperate. The ability to see beyond yourself. Rav Yehuda Mital, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the example they set, you don't see pogroms in Alon Shvut. I need not tell you what pictures have come out of Panovich in the year 2015, Jew versus Jew. Rav Yudel Rosenberg was revered. The whole literature about him, I told you they accused him of plagiarism. With the, he had the vast secular knowledge, and he Kala Torah Kula, and he was a Makubo. His grandson was my classmate. And the grandson was one of the brightest guys in YU, in my time at least. You all know him, I mentioned to you. He was a Chaver Knesset, Yehuda Ben Meir. You've heard the name Menachem? Before your time, a Maftalnik. Google him, Yehuda Ben Meir. Yudel Rosenberg, named after his grandfather. When he went to Montreal, the people in Toronto were very upset. He came back to support the Erev. Went around the city. He knew the city inside out. He had been there many years. Went around. Saw the Erev that Rabbi Graubat built. Came out in public. L'chazek, l'ametz, to support. And the Erev was accepted by everybody. Time moves on. And the community in Toronto starts moving north. Rabbi Graubat is gone, and there are many rabbanim in Toronto, but the most famous, the man who was considered the greatest Lamdan, was Rabbi Avraham Price. I know many people who were devotees of Rabbi Avraham Price. In 1950, in his doctorate, there's a whole picture of where they moved, how they pushed north. And, you know, this goes on. If you study the New York City, for instance, you'll see the first area of settlement was the East Side. From the East Side, they moved to Harlem. From Harlem, they moved to the Bronx and Brooklyn. From the Bronx and Brooklyn, they moved to Queens. From Queens, they moved to the Five Towns. You know, time marches on. And then Jersey as well, Bergenfield, what else is next to Bergen? Teaneck. And it's amazing, just amazing. The community spreads out. In 1950, Rabbi Avraham Price wrote an article in the Hapades Rabbinical Journal that we've spoken about so many times, and he explained that there's now and it is necessary to build a new, larger Erev in Toronto to include northern Toronto, where the Jews are moving. Rabbi Price was born in 1900 in Kielce in Poland. He was a disciple of Avraham Bernstein, the Sach Tshuva Rebbe, the Avnei Nezer. Chassidish Yid, like the Rav and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he spent time in Berlin, he spent time in Paris before coming to Toronto, running away from Europe in 1937. It is said that in Berlin he was very close and studied with Reb Chaim Heller, which tells you already the level that Rabbi Price was on. A guy named Rakefet, when he deals with German Orthodoxy, has said many times the Beis Medrash that Reb Chaim Heller organized in Berlin never really succeeded. And the reason is very simple. In order to be a Talmud Reb Chaim Heller, who knew Kol HaTorah Kula in every language under the sun, you had to be a Reb Chaim Heller to master both worlds. How many people are they like that? Came to Toronto, organized the yeshiva in 1941, ordained three of his students who become the first rabbanim to be ordained in Canada. He remained in Toronto until his death in 1994. Now, by 1950s, they're on to 70,000 Jews in Toronto. And the new Erev would be enclosed by the Humber and Don Rivers and Lake Ontario. The only real major change in the Erev was his reliance on the telegraph poles and wires that run the entire length of Wilson Avenue, which extends for the eastern end of the city to the western end. I think it should be from the eastern end of the city to the western end. Now, why is this Erev superior than what you had before? And here there's a very interesting description which I can only relate to you. Do you know these streets? Do you recognize these names? So he says that originally the Erev in Toronto that closed in the rivers was in the middle of a street. That's where the poles were. So you wound up with an Erev where the wires, one side of the street you could walk on Shabbat and carry, and one side you couldn't. Rabbi Graubart relied on telephone poles and wires that ran in the middle of Bloor Street, thereby excluding the northern sidewalk from the Erev. This created potential confusion among the people. However, on Wilson Avenue, the telegraph poles and wires were located on the northern sidewalk, so both sidewalks were included in the new Erev. Very fascinating. If you do a movie in Erevin, it would be fascinating to see an Erev in the middle of the street. In Borough Park, there used to be signs, Ad Khan Ha'erev, to warn people, because Borough Park grew gradually. At first, the Hasidim were 13, 14, 15, 16, beyond 16th Avenue, very little. Then suddenly 17th, 18th. But 19th and 20th was all Italians. Today, right through McDonald Avenue, it's all Hasidic Jews. The Italians never had it better. They sold row houses that were worth originally $20,000. They sold them off for $800,000, $900,000. Retired to Florida, laughed at the world, and thank God for creating Gera Hasidim who want to live near the Gera Shtibl and the Gera Yeshiva and Borough Park and the Bubba, etc., etc. And they buy, where they get the money is beyond my comprehension. They gut the house and rebuild a little mansion within the confines of space. But the Erev, you had to have a sign, Atkana Erev. Imagine today you don't have signs anymore because the Erev is continuous. The Borough Park Erev feeds right in to the Flatbush Erev. But could you imagine in the middle of the street? That's where the Erev ends. Then there was another problem. In 1921, when Rabbi Graubart built the Erev, the total population of Toronto was less than 600,000 citizens. Never a question of Rishut HaRabim the Oraita. In 1950, 1.2 million citizens. Adam, how many citizens are there in Toronto today?
That's what you include. Many, many millions.
Must be quite a few million. I'm going to be there. I'm going to add one more person for two more people for a week.
What's the Canadian population? 22 million?
I don't know. I'm not an expert, but Adam is a Canadian.
25.
And Toronto's very big today. 1.2 million. And the streets are very wide. Many are more than 16 a month. Maybe Toronto has the status of Rishut HaRabim the Oraita. And here you get involved in everything we spoke about in so much detail. What? Don't worry. Let Toronto one thing for sure. It's one of the, what is a major street? 2.5 million. Yasher Koyach, way beyond 600,000. 2.5 million already sounds like Brooklyn with Reb Moshe's problems, and he gets involved with the whole question. What do you mean 600,000 in the street? What do you call the Rishut HaRabim? Do people in the trolley cars count? Do people in the cars count? And he cites all the great achronim in Poland to paskin lahalacha. If you're in a car and if you're in a bus, you do not count towards the 600,000. And then he quotes his Talmud, Rabbi Gedalia Felder. Do you recognize the name? Talmud of Rav Avram Price. This is the Felder family. Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, also a tremendous Talmud Chacham. That the old story we spoke about, the streets are not wide open. Moshe Schwartz cannot cross anywhere he wants in Toronto, or he'll get a ticket for jaywalking. The streets are not wide open. It's not like in Machne Yisrael, where you could walk and no one stopped you. And he goes on and on, bringing all the shittat. And he acknowledges that people who oppose, people who claim it's not so, but he claims, Rabbi Price, that he is building a better Erev even than Rabbi Graubart built. And he talks about the chumras that he's instituted, and he's putting lechi in many places on every telephone pole, even though the wire seems to go right on top of the telephone pole, but if it veers a little to the side, there's a ten tefachim lechi underneath. And he deals with the problem, Mukav Ladira, the Tzirat HaPetach, Wilson Avenue, and he feels that this Erev is Kosha Lemahadrin. He publishes in a Pades, he asks people, correspond, let me know what you think. One rabbi answers, Rabbi Menachem Pollack of New York, I went to school with his grandchildren, the Chashev Rav, and he deals with the whole question of the river, and he feels that since Toronto is surrounded on two sides, this area by major rivers, he feels that they have a malus moch to build the Erev. According to Rabbi Price, and he gives you the sources, he claims that he got responsa from Rabbis Isaac Halevi Herzog and Rabbi Ben Uziel, the chief rabbis of Israel. However, Rabbi Min says these responsa have not come to light yet. No one has discovered them, so we can't deal with what they had to say in their being machshir, validating the Erev. Initially, Rabbi Price's Erev was accepted by all. And then, gentlemen, a Hungarian refugee family found refuge in Toronto, and not only found refuge in Toronto, but did extremely well. It's like I told someone this morning in this very building, I was introduced to parents who are looking for a school for their son who will be graduating high school next year. And I looked at their faces, I knew right away these are Syrians from Flatbush and Beale. I knew right away where they're from. I hear the name. And I tell them right away, my student, Srila, turns out that my student is the son-in-law, his wife is the daughter, they're cousins, and we got to talking about my student. So I said, Isaac, etc. I said, there was just an article in Yediot, in the money section, about a year and a half ago, with a picture of my student saying, this man is worth $2 billion. So they went, his cousin said, so I say, listen, I said to Isaac, we got to sit and talk. $2 billion, a little bit I have to take for my causes. He says, Rebbe, do you believe everything you read in the newspapers? So I say, Isaac, one thing I can tell you, Yedid Ahronot is not going to write about Aaron Rakefet that he's worth $2 billion. I absolutely guarantee it. Gentlemen, the Reichmans, $2 billion in their heyday, chicken feed. They conquered the world. The Reichmans, that's who we're talking about, okay? About them we can say billionaires. About Rakefet, absolutely not. About my student Isaac, somewhere in the middle, probably closer to the billionaire status, but we'll let it stand at that. Rafi, they were ungarisha. They came in with their own rabbi. They found fault with the Erev. And there was a big machloket, like Yehuda Maita, Ora V'Simcha, a big machloket in Toronto. And they found fault that the Erev is not checked every week. Rabbi Price said certain parts of the Erev are in areas where there's high voltage. No one in the world will interfere with those electric wires unless they want to electrocute themselves. You don't have to check everything. And machloket on top of machloket. So what ultimately happened in Toronto, and it wasn't simple, because by the 1980s, there's an organized rabbinate, and they were very upset with the concept of the Reichman family, that area building its own Erev. But ultimately, for the sake of peace, they gave in. And Toronto today is somewhat like Yerushalayim. There's a general Erev, and within the Erev is the one built by the Reichman's rabbi, I'm told, and you have your choice. You can be samach on the general Erev, and if you live in that little area, which is a smaller area, so there you have an Erev, which they call an Erev Lamahadrin, and it's much the same like Yerushalayim, where we once figured out in this area where we're sitting must be three different Erev. There's the local Erev, there's the Agudat Yisrael Erev around Givat Mordechai in general, and then there's the big Erev around the city. And I just drove in the area, the northern area, the northern eastern area of Jerusalem, and wherever you can see the Erev, the boundaries on the highway. Wherever you go with your car, you can point it out. It's very fascinating, the wire, the poles, the strings on the wire, the decorations. So people should see the wire. You shouldn't knock it over. I don't know, but it's very high. No truck is that high that it's going to knock it over. But nevertheless, maybe a plane shouldn't land on it. I don't know. But you see the Erev is clearly demarcated. So that's the story of Taranto. Rabbi Price also went on with a long quintus that when it comes to Erev, there is a tradition lahakel. In other words, there's certain issues that we have a tradition lahakel. One of them is, for instance, Avelet. Avelet, you know, you have many shilas that come up, and probably the most classic shila you're going to get in modern times is the bodies are shipped to Israel. The bodies are shipped to Israel. Does anyone go with the bodies? What about the people that stay behind? Sometimes people can't go. They're elderly, they're sick. When does Avelet begin? It was a tremendous machloket achronim 150, 140 years ago. Today we always paskin the minute the body, you accompany the body to the airport, the minute you turn around, you take off your shoes, the Avelet begins. So you can wind up having instances where relatives get up 2 days earlier than those who accompanied the body to Israel. Or if the Gadol HaMishpacha is sitting shiva and never went, so you come back from Israel, and literally a day or so after you get back, a day or two, you're finished with Shiva. You follow me? You get up with the Gadol. So there is a tradition. So he brings down by Erev that even if I was Mekil and I'd not say all the Shitat, but he quotes the Chatam Sofi, he quotes the Rush, what we've quoted all the years, and I quote it now, anyone with a brain in his head will realize that the Erev I have built in Taranto is ideal, with three sides surrounded by water, and the fourth side has a Tzurat HaPetach, which is better than any Tzurat HaPetach which I have seen in the world. And I heard a story when the Machlokes began and they start questioning the Erev, they contacted the Rabbonim in Israel, and one of the great Rabbonim in the so-called Haredi world says, what's your problem in Taranto? You have a great expert there, Rav Avram Price. And he said, talk with him. In spite of Rabbi Price's defense of the Erev, the Dvar HaRabbonim of Taranto allowed Rabbi Seifer to erect his own Erev. Rabbi Seifer is the Rav for the Reichman family. And this new Erev project was completed in December 1995, shortly after Rabbi Price's death. Rabbi Seifer's Erev was based upon the decisions of Rav Shalom Yosef Eliashiv. So you get the full picture. My dear students, we have arrived at the high point and the last point of today's shiur, but the high point. I have a dear student, first of all, Rabbi Yeshua Grinstein. Maybe you know the name. Some of you may yet go to him. He runs Rabbi Riskin's rabbinic program for Chutz Laretz. His father was my student. He's my virtual student for many, many years. Now, I wrote from Washington Avenue to Washington Street. I evidently influenced a few others to start writing. Touching History from Williamsburg to Jerusalem. Who wrote the book? No? Rabbi Shalom Gold, absolutely. This is Rabbi Gold, with whom, first of all, I know him decades. Secondly, I had a big machlokes with him, an intellectual argument in front of Rabbanim and Yom HaTzmut quite a few years ago already. What was our argument? Rabbi Gold claimed that the Satmar Hasidim are among the worst Jews alive, Parish Menetzibul, that the Rambam says. and literally write them out. Rakefet claimed the Satmar are our greatest future source for more good Jews. We just have to influence them and be makar of them to Yiddishkeit. Rakefet's claim.
What happened to the Torah Card? Is that part of
it? No, the Torah Card is not part of Satma, but they're fellow bedmates, roommates of Satma, of the extreme Satma. So I want you to know that two great Satma youngsters with all the biggest jichas in the world are now serving in the Israeli Defense Forces. Their pictures are all over the place. But what's most important, they retain their kippot. That's number one. Number two, Makar Rishon this past weekend, if I'm not mistaken, I haven't read it yet, but I think it's Makar Rishon, I saw it already, has a whole article on the underground movement of Satma to come back to the totality of Jewish existence, the Jewish people, the state of Israel. So I come down on the side of Rakefet, even though I love Rabbi Shalom Gold. Now, evidently, from Williamsburg to Jerusalem, from Washington Avenue to Washington Street. Okay. Yoshua Grinstein tells me you're talking about Toronto. As a result of Toronto, West Hempstead has an Erev. And now, let me read to you a little bit from this volume. And he's describing, he was rabbi in Toronto, right? From Toronto he goes to, he was a musmach of Nei Yisrael, Toronto. From Toronto he comes to West Hempstead. West Hempstead was an interesting story. I'll just say it very briefly, but maybe one of you will do a doctorate one day. It's a very fascinating story. As the Jews are moving out to the suburbs, West Hempstead is ideally located, and it's not as flashy or as expensive as the Five Towns. So it starts to attract a very nice crowd of Jews. They organize in Israel. These are Shomer Shabbos Jews. It was unheard of in Long Island. There should be Shomer Shabbos Jews. But these are the 60s into the 70s. The world is changing. Now, when they began the in Israel, they called upon one of the greatest rabbanim to come out of YU, Rabbi Harold or Tzvi Kanatopsky. He was a musmach out of the 40s, according to a guy named Rakefet. Whenever they ask him who is the arguably the Rav's top Talmud from every decade, Rakefet says for the 40s, it is Rabbi Harold Kanatopsky. He was fabulous. And he had a shul in Crown Heights. Rabbi Lichtenstein grew up in a shul. This was Crown Heights. There was a little Rebbe just beginning them, known as Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. This was Crown Heights. Then a decade or two later, Crown Heights starts to disappear. The Afro-Americans coming in. Only the Lubavitcher remain because of the Rebbe. And Rabbi Kanatopsky needs a shtela. And they bring him out to West Hempstead. And he was a man who was gold. It did not work in West Hempstead. He was used to a big city rabbinate. He couldn't hack a suburban rabbinate. Whatever, it has to be analyzed. What would the problems be? A very fascinating sociological, historic doctorate. Then Rabbi Kanatopsky went on Aliyah, and Rabbi Shalom Gold came out to West Hempstead from Toronto. So he writes, he talks about in Toronto, things were progressing well, but Shabbos became a big problem for my family. Toronto was the first and for many years the only city in North America that had a citywide Erev. It was established by Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart, the author of five volumes of Responsa called Chavalim B'Nimim. I think it's four volumes, but check it out. Okay. This means that his wife, Rabbi Gold's wife, Bela, had grown up all her life in a city that had an Erev. Now in West Hempstead with a baby, she was confined to the house on Shabbos. Something had to be done. So I decided to investigate the feasibility of making an Erev around the town. I'm reading from the book beginning on page 163. Around the third Sunday in West Hempstead, I got into my car and began driving. I circled the entire perimeter of the town in every direction. I stopped at car at times, got out, walked for blocks. My neck began to hurt from peering up at all the telephone and electric wires. But at the end of that Sunday excursion, I knew one thing. Building an area in West Hempstead was a feasible option, and there was no reason to delay getting started. Watch. It is a beautiful document. Before I could take this area to the next level, I needed to discuss it with someone greater than myself. I had had the opportunity to get to know Reb Moshe Feinstein over the years. In fact, we had a pretty close relationship. I called him and asked his advice. And I have to tell you, many Rabbanim, myself included, if I could call Reb Moshe, I could ask him anything. He was Reb Moshe Feinstein. When Reb Moshe died, they threw the mold away. You understand? It's hard to explain it. I told Reb Moshe about my new job and the challenges facing my Erev-less community. Since he was the halachic authority of the generation, I felt I needed his blessing to go ahead with my plans. Reb Moshe heard me out, then he asked me one question. How many congregational rabbis live in West Hempstead? One, I replied. Reb Moshe asked me, what do you mean? Is there one rabbi in addition to you? Or are you the only one? I am the only rabbi in town, I said. And that's the case, Shalom. Build the Erev. Build the Erev. And you see what Reb Moshe was telling him. If there's more than one rabbi, you have to consult. You don't want to have machlokes. You can already have machlokes. These people want, these people don't want. If you're the Murad Yatra and no one else is there, do and build the Erev. Now, here he describes, how do you build the Erev? He has Reb Moshe's blessing. He was in town for a short while, but he was giving a shiur. And a number of men attending his shiurim on a regular basis were interested. He spelt out his plans. He requested their assistance. Before I knew it, the impromptu Erev committee, he mentions names. I've taught many members of these families, from Ben, Bert Pechman, Bernie Zivotofsky, Marvin Wachspress. You recognize these names?
Yes.
Okay, these are all people I know. Marvin Wachspress is very interesting. He was made frum by a shliach from Israel, a lady who came to America, whatever organization, Young Judea, whatnot, and she became nice frum in America, but she made him frum. Her children are frum. It's an amazing thing what happens in America. Children of B'nai Torah may even be towards the black spectrum. Pechman, Zivotofsky, Waxpress, wow. He needs a refuah shleimah. He had a stroke years ago. God should be wonderful, wonderful people. Excuse me? Ah, so you're every Sunday morning.
Zivotofsky still jobs every day.
Every Sunday morning, they work. How are we going to build this Erev? They started playing with lumber, people who knew how to be carpenters. They were building lechis to put on the posts underneath the electric wires, the telephone wires. The Erev committee went from pole to pole around the perimeter of the town. Since the Long Island Railroad abuts the town, its gate served as a natural wall for the Erev along one side of West Hempstead, making our job much easier. You see, a railroad, halavai in Israel, they would have gates built around railroads. I don't have to elaborate. Maybe the new railroads they're building, they intend to build gates. But you know how many people have been killed here trying to cross railroads and suddenly they got stuck on the tracks. Most of the utility poles in town were ready-made Erev material as well. And there wasn't much that we needed to do. But in certain places, the telephone wires weren't hanging straight enough, or there was some other technical problem. And then we were forced to build a lechi here and a lechi there to solve each individual issue that rose. It was slow going, but we persevered, making steady progress on our community project. We tried to use what was already in place, turning to our construction experts only if we absolutely needed to. It wasn't long before our Erev really began to take shape. And then he describes how he got in touch with the Staten Island community, where they already had an Erev. Moshe Friedowitz, I know the family too, lives in Harnof today, and they told them what they did in Staten Island. Now, at this point, he has to call in an expert. It's like I tell you all the time, the theoretical material on Erev, I think I did very well. 2 years of Shehur and we did a world. But if I'm going to build an Erev, I got to call in a man who's an expert, who's built and built and built and knows all the technical little matters. Who did he call in? My chaver, my classmate, my colleague, Rabbi Shimon Ira. And he, you know, a relatively young man at the time, but already making a brilliant name for himself. And here he tells an interesting story that when Shimi Ida came to see him, he shows him, he gives him a Mesillat Yesharim. And Rabbi Gold looks at the Mesillat Yesharim and he takes a look. He was Shimi Ida's counselor in Camp Aguda. And he wrote a dedication in the Mesillat Yesharim to Shimi Ida. Anyway, any question he had, he contacted Reb Moshe Feinstein, and the Erev became operational. It's unbelievable. But the most interesting part of the description is with City Hall. Now, and on page 167, he has to rent West Hempstead. One more detail to be taken care of. I set up a meeting with the town representative, Mr. Francis Purcell, to discuss the matter. Quote, I need something that's actually very simple to do, but will probably sound a little crazy to you. I would like to purchase the town from you for a dollar. The words hung in the air for a few seconds. Purcell stared at me, a bemused look on his face. What's that, Rabbi? Say that again. You want to what? I want to buy the town for a buck. He was full of questions. I tried to supply the answers. It took the council a little time just to grasp the concept that Jews were not allowed to carry in the streets on Shabbos unless one made a halachic delineation. Eventually, we cleared it all up. You know, just like Mechirat Chametz. And they understood. There was a Jewish lawyer on staff at the municipality who realized the significance of the planned lease of the town to the Jewish community. He grasped what a story this would be. The publicity angle that could be played up and the extent to which this could enhance the town's image. Erev Bedikat Chametz, 1972. My phone rang. This is Francis Purcell from the West Hempstead Municipality. I'm calling to invite you down to City Hall for a meeting at 1 o'clock this afternoon. 1 o'clock. Erev Bedikat Chametz. It's not the best time in the world. I still had many things I needed to do before Pesach. But the town wanted a meeting with the rabbi. Then we are going to have a meeting. My wife is busy with Pesach preparations and so are the neighbors. And the kids needed to be kept busy. And that's why I drove down to City Hall with my station wagon filled with kids. All in all, a grand total of 12 kids came along with me for the ride. We entered the City Hall together, 12 kids and one rabbi, ceremoniously ushered into the Grand Council Meeting Hall. All 12 kids took their seats in the row behind me. They peered around them, curiously taking it all in. Every member of the municipality was there. Everyone. They stared at the kids. The kids stared back. You know, Goyim, how many children do they have today? Without further ado, they handed me a copy of the documents which clearly stated our agreement in legalese.
Whereas the Jewish law dictates that one may not carry from one domain to another during the course of the Sabbath day. And whereas an eruv is a legal measure provided by the rabbis. And whereas it becomes necessary to purchase the town for this purpose. There must have been 15 whereases on that document. We would like to welcome Rabbi Golden and all his children to City Hall. The statement was greeted by clapping, perhaps due to the council's admiration of my huge tribe. The representative went on. The town of West Hempstead, he continued, has decided to lease the grounds of the Erev to you, Rabbi Gold. Thank you very much, I responded, smiling broadly to one and all. It was a powerful moment. The council members sat there beaming at me, gratified in their magnanimity, proud of having worked this challenge out, happy to be providing all the town citizens with services needed. I would like to lease the land for a period of 20 years, I said, and to retain the right to renew the lease at that time. When members of my shul later asked me why only 20 years, not more, I explained that even though I was allowed to ask for 40 years according to the Aruch HaShulchan, I decided to ask for only 20 years because there was no doubt in my mind that we would long be gone from beautiful West Hempstead by then and living in the state of Israel. Despite my fervent hopes, Mashiach still hasn't arrived, but my family and I had the good fortune to have made Aliyah before the 20 years ended. I still remember calling Rabbi Yehudi Kellerman, that's the rabbi of today, who succeeded me as Rav, to make sure to renew the lease when it was up. Now, the rest of this chapter is very, very interesting because the publicity this got. The New York Times interviews Rabbi Gold. All the local papers interview Rabbi Gold. People can't stop calling. Wow, if this was something they never heard about. West Hempstead, America, middle class. And Jews who care, who observe. And he ends off the chapter with a beautiful story. There was one particular lechi that kept on coming down. It seems like we were constantly repairing this lechi, which had been put up on the recommendation of Rabbi Shimon Ida to fulfill the opinion of the Chazon Ish. It so happened that right across the street from this lechi lived a non-Jewish man who couldn't help but notice a continuous stream of Jews constantly trying to repair a string and stick across the street from his house. Finally, he decided to cross the street and ask us what was going on. I explained all about Erev, how it wasn't cooperating. "Don't you worry, Rabbi," he replied. "I'm going to watch your Erev like a baby and make sure it doesn't come down. You'll see. From now on, you won't have anything to worry about. Just trust me. Your lechi is safe with me." You know something? He gave us his word, and it never came down again. So I have to say, again, it's what a guy named Rakhetar has taught for many generations. We cannot teach hatred. They're non-Jews who are fine, wonderful, upright, decent, caring people. They're exceptions. Lower Langer, we know, with Germany. But even in Germany, there were non-Jews who risked their lives to save Jews. A student, Aryeh Liebman, sent me a link. I thank Aryeh. Remember, we've spoken about the Munkacha film on Channel 2 on evidently Yom HaShoah. They showed a documentary on people who survived Munkacs. It's a small country. My wife knew one of the women in that movie. I hope she's still alive. It was only done a few years ago. People who survived the Holocaust
looking at the film from Munkacs and pointing themselves out. There is so much to comment on that. If I had time, I would show it in class and we could have a month worth of discussion. The man with the big kippah who's angry at God, which you can understand. Looking at the pictures, how all these children, 90% of them, are killed by Hitler. It's the first recorded movie we have of thousands of Jews singing Hatikva. There's so much to comment on. But the most beautiful part is the Hungarian family Strauss, non-Jewish, who risked their lives to save this Munkacs kid. And he and his Hungarian counterpart, who was the son of the family that saved him, they're like brothers. They Skype each other once a week, and they speak to each other in Hungarian and in Hebrew. This kid was the only non-Jewish kid who went to the general gymnasium of the Zionist movement. For whatever reasons, his parents wanted him to be there, they get a better education. And this kid's father fought with them. He taught, take him in. And I said, what are you taking a non-Jew into the gymnasium? He can be a spy, this, that. And later, the teacher who fought to get this kid in knocks on the door, will you take my son in? They risked their lives, because had that been discovered, the Nazis would have executed them. And it leaves you with such a feeling of thought and thinking and humanity and decency. And the Hungarian is non-Jewish. They show you his parents when they planted the tree in the lane of the Hasidim Atolam in Yad Vashem. There's a tree dedicated to their memory. And this kid, they're like brothers. A lot to think about. Thankful we're Jews, thankful we're here. And we have a purpose in life. Mindafkein Vaita. So today was an interesting shiur. It's amazing. Toronto, Rabbi Graubat, Rabbi Price, the Machloikis, Rabbi Sofer, the Reichmans. By the way, the Reichman family are now in the third, fourth generation. They've branched out. They're already Reichmans that are married with Hesda boys. I know some of them. My grandsons know some of them. So the family is branching out. They've had their success. They've had some tragedy in the family. It's like I answered someone today, or like I would answer him in lectures. I'm not impressed by any Hashkafic viewpoint, because there's no Hashkafic viewpoint where we solve all problems and we can say we have 90% success. So the Reichmans have had their problems too. I need not elaborate. But overall, it's a beautiful, tremendous success story. And I thank Rabbi Grinstein once again. The dessert, the icing on the cake, how the Toronto area of Rabbi Gold comes to West Hempstead, Baylor. I know these people, and I taught his daughters, I know him intimately. And Baylor is very upset all her life. She had an Erev, Mapitom, that she's going to live without an Erev, locked in the house on Shabbos. And he builds an Erev. Rabbi Shimon Eider, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, this is all part of a world that has gone by, unfortunately, but a world that we can learn a great amount from. Next week, we pick up, again, we're heading for the tail end, but again, very fascinating material. Why we should be Mekel with a Rivim Bizman Hazel, we'll get involved with Mikvot, you'll see. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, is a very sensitive shir. Only come to class if you have a soul, spelled S-O-U-L. We're going to talk about the seventh Rebbe's relationship with his wife. It's fascinating, moving, human material. And I stand in awe of Rabbi Steinsaltz. He writes, and I've read a lot, and I know a lot, and I have insight. I told you, I have the periscope, the Ugrona. Beautiful. Cannot be equaled. 9:05 tomorrow. Bring, what's it, Bahab here yet? Bring breakfast to class. have a ball, have a feast. Just be here at 9:05, except for Yomo, who has to be here at 9, getting organized. I have a lot of freebies tomorrow, but some of the freebies now. Michael, do me a favor. Take this for Rabbi Rubin, who's seeing the queen right now and celebrating. He's celebrating the birth of the next. She is fourth in line to inherit the throne. And Michael, are you celebrating the birth of the Belzer Rebbe's new grandson? That's the real, I told my wife, big deal. There's another kid to inherit to be the queen of England. That's no big deal for me. But bells, that the Rebbe had so much trouble conceiving his wife, and finally he has a son with miracles, that son has produced many heirs to the throne. So anyone who's a Belzer Chassid, and it's in my family, my wife's a Belzer from her father's side, a Medrashitzer from her mother's side, and Chaim Herbie Maltz, a Belzer, be assured there'll be succession, and there may be machloket yet, who will reign. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, remember we spoke about the Shepsa Ravin class with the machlokes over the Arab last week? Chaim Schnitzer, my virtual student, uncovered a piece on the Shepsa Rav's grandson from 1940, the family produced from Jews. I have a question to ask. There's a furtick from Elizabeth, if I recall. There's a furtick at YU in public relations, if I'm not mistaken. Are you descendants of the Shepsa Rav? Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, a bibliography of all his writings as put together by his students. Let me see if it's here. I'm holding the wrong paper. This is about the tradition special issue that came out in honor, now in memory of Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. Anyone who reads modern Hebrew, a very insightful, beautiful a eulogy for Rabbi Lichtenstein by his Talmud, Rabbi Chaim Navon, worth reading. This is the weekly magazine of Mochach. If you're interested in Chumash, it tells you the best places in all of Israel to get Chumash. And believe it or not, one of the places is Rav Chaim Berlin number one, exactly a 1 minute walk from my house. I've never eaten there. I didn't grow up here. Chumash doesn't speak to me. I still prefer a hot dog with sauerkraut and mustard, and even Tiratzvi got the message. They now make American hot dogs. You have a choice: Polish hot dogs, Hungarian hot dogs, American hot dogs. And I want to tell you, they are the same poison like the American hot dog.
Chaim Berlin one is next to the pizza place.
Yeah, exactly. Here's a beautiful story from the New York Times. Beginning again, the love story of Leonard Lauder and Judy Glickman. Not exactly two or two individuals who lost their spouses and how they get together. What I want to know is, what does this mean? The ceremony when they remarried was officiated by two of Mrs. Lauder's three sons and one of her daughters-in-law, all rabbis. I'd like to know what rabbi. The girl today could be a musmechet of Rabbi Riskin. Anything is possible. I am curious. Finally, for Michael Miller, reward for coming to class. The articles the New York Times comes up with is unbelievable. Renato Aldiazoia, if I'm pronouncing it right, the oldest living Yankee, reflects on his career. I admit I'm ashamed to say I never heard of this name until the New York Times article.
He only played one or two games.
All right, but Renato Aldiazoa.
95 years old.
Well, Herbie, you're a bucky in the history of the Yankees the New York Times. My dear students, until we meet again in health. And by the way, I can just tell you, there was a little discussion upstairs why you were suffering financially, so people are worried they're going to lose their jobs. So I told them, I'm the only one not worried, because I teach, you people have to make a living. I teach to keep alive. So Baruch Hashem, as long as I have students, I'm alive. Gentlemen, the Rebbe didn't make it up. The lead article in Arut Sheva, Meet the Satma Hasidim Planning a Zionist Settlement. We have to make a Shefi Yonu B'Levu Malcha. And when Yom Yerushalayim comes, we can say Hallel without any hesitancy.
With a bracha.
I don't say with a bracha, the Talmud of the Rav, but you say with a bracha.
Well, what about the Erev and Kugar Hill?
Well, we spoke about that last year. Yeah, that's old history. That's what Moshe approved it.
Yeah.
And Rakefet said, once there was an Erev and Kugar Hills, every community in the world is going to want an Erev. And boy, was I right. But Rav Moshe approved
it. Was the first Erev in America?
No. Muncie was before. Yeah, Muncie was before. Yeah. What a beautiful picture.
It's the head article.
Head article. The lead article. Gentlemen, until we meet again in health and happiness, das v'danya. Thank you from the bottom of my heart of being my students.
I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Wait, one second.
Vladimir Slaypak. Vladimir Slaypak.
I want to ask you.
I found out about it on Tuesday. He passed away Yom HaTzmaut. How is it possible that there was almost no publicity, no public announcements, nothing on the radio, nothing on the news?
How many people know the name?
As many as he wants.
Yeah, you're right.
They're going to make you pay for it.
I'll copy it.
You can have the original.
That's great.
I'll copy it. It'll be with me tomorrow morning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow, no, there was no announcement. But you got
to finally, there was an article in the paper, and there was an article.
Yeah, but you got to understand, Vayakum Dachadash. Yomar heard of Vladimir Slepak? No, here's someone from Russia. That's not who we're talking about. That's life, my friend.
I mean, Sharansky called him the father of the refusers.
Correct. That's correct.
He said we all stood on his shoulders.
That's correct.
He led us and inspired us.
Correct.
And made us determined to continue, the struggle.
I think he was a Chavir Knesset.
Who?
Slepak, if I'm not mistaken.
He didn't have a happy life here.
No.
I think he had a lot of family issues, as far as I understand that. I have the Charlestein family. I don't know if you know that name at all.
Charlestein.
The Philadelphia family. They were Rita Sue Charlestein, who lives in French Hill. She was tremendously involved in the Soviet Jewry movement. So she happens to be a personal friend of ours. She didn't know.
Wow.
And she knew Vladimir Slepak personally. She knew all the refusniks personally.
A lot of people had a hard life here. Ida Nudel never made her peace with the attitude here. Give away your shalom.
You know this rabbi's goal.
Thank you.
Send me gods to Grace.
She will.
Yeah, where did I see Grace? Was she here at the Hesbeth for a baron?
We were both here.
Ah, you were both there. So that's why I said.
Last week?
Right. Yeah. This last week, yeah.
Yeah, last week.